Hey, everybody, and welcome to The Brand Called You. So the other day I was sitting on my parents' balcony in Brooklyn, and it was late at night, and there was this exquisite full moon. And I swear to you, I could see the man in the moon. And I've been seeing this guy since I was a kid. I'm absolutely convinced that he's there. And I guess I'm not alone, because so many people I know want to know, is there life out there? And that's why I feel so completely excited about today's guest, Lucas Ellerbrock. He's an astronomer and a science writer from the Netherlands whose columns on astronomy have regularly appeared in National Geographic magazine. In addition to working as a research director at ELEAF, which is an Earth observation data service provider, and acting as the chairman for the Royal Dutch Association for Meteorology and Astronomy, among other things. He also was the author of a really, really popular book called Planet Hunters, about humanity's search for planets and extraterrestrial life. So Lucas, welcome. It's just a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you, Lisa. So it's really good to be here.
Yes. I have to tell you, when I was in third grade, we had a very mean teacher, Mrs. Ross. She was a torturesome teacher, but she did one thing well. She arranged a class trip for us to go to the Newark Museum, Newark, New Jersey, where they had a planetarium. And I only remember one line that stuck with me for my entire life. The man speaking behind the stars said, "There are more stars than every grain of sand in the world." It was such a revolutionary thing for me that it kind of piqued my interest in outer space for the rest of my life. And I was curious, I think we all have that one moment. What was it that, did you have a moment like that which kind of just suddenly got you excited about the world outside of Earth?
Yes. I guess there were multiple moments, but one that stands out is that I was, my grandfather was always an inspiration for me, because he was a very, he wasn't that old fashioned at all. He constructed all kinds of things at home, and he was really, made his own computer, assembled it from different parts. And this was like in the 90s. So he was already late in his 70s, and he had this thing working on his desk. And that was like really the pre-digital age. Anyway, one day he took me to also a planetarium, but this was one of those like semi-dome shows, right? You got to the cinema, but the cinema is like a you're inside this ball, this sphere, and it's projected onto the screen, and you get to have a tour through the universe. And I'm sure you've been to one, and if not, then you should. But we got a tour through the universe, and one of the things that was shown there were black holes. But back then, nobody has seen a black hole yet. I mean, quite recently, there's been a photograph taken of a silhouette of a black hole. But back then, there was just a question mark on the screen. And like all in this, in the sky among the stars and all these galaxies and everything, was very awesome. And that was just this question mark. And I thought, why this is... Why don't we yet know everything there is to know? And that was a constant inspiration, actually.
Yeah, actually, this is a little aside, but I remember when we were dating in college, I had a friend. She was very funny. She was always telling me about these kind of loser guys that she ended up dating. And I remember she's like, "You're not going to believe who I'm dating. He's the guy who's the pointer at the planetarium." There was a man that was hired just to point to stars. She's like, "I'm dating the pointer."
Well, I guess, yeah. Well, we've come a long way, though, that nowadays these people that present the stars to you can be quite popular, actually.
Well, so here's my really philosophic question to you. You know, you have spent arguably the better part of your professional life looking in one way or another for extraterrestrial life, life outside of Earth. And so have so many people. They're always asking this big question, right? Which is there life beyond Earth? And my question is, why do we care? I mean, why is that actually an important question?
Yeah, I think it's one of those questions where you can say a lot of things about it. It's an existential question, a philosophical question. I think it is purely curiosity driven. And also it's a question whose definitive answer can never be anything but yes. I mean, we can never know for sure that we're not alone, that we are alone in the universe.
But
right? We can never be 100% certain that we are alone. There can always be a possibility. Yeah. We know now that it's not only the stars, but there's more planets than stars. So more planets than grains of sand on Earth. So there's a lot of possibilities for life to exist. And it's just tantalizing that possibility exists and we want a definitive answer. And the only way we're ever going to get a definitive answer to that question is if that answer turns out to be yes, there is life on other planets.
Let's go back to your philosophic existential answer, because for me, I think we barely are fascinated with each other. You know, we have no critical thinking skills. We don't see beyond the obvious, even with our own neighbors.
Yeah.
Why would we be curious? I mean, why are we even ready to conceive of something beyond? What is the existential answer for you?
I think, well, for me, I'm also curious, and myself, like any other human, I also like to compare. And humans are also fond of compliments to themselves. So we hope to, well, we're quite proud of humanity in a way. I mean, there's a lot of things not to be proud of, but there are also things that we can think, well, we've done pretty well. We've managed to like go to the moon or to have all these medical advancements that has given us a longer life than it was. So how do we compare to other species in the universe? And in the hope that we will find a species that that is, well, even more advanced, that can be used as an inspiration, or a less advanced species that is interesting to study. And a less also probably exploit, which is also one of humanity's traits. But it's just all, I think it's all curiosity driven. We always want to be chasing horizons and see what's behind them.
If you imagine life beyond Earth in your wildest, most creative incarnation, you don't see those little science fiction guys with the helmets like that came down to Earth in those early 1960s movies, right? I mean, I'm really curious, in your most poetic incarnation, what you see.
Well, I find those things quite poetic, actually. The anachronistic aliens with the funny helmets, the little green man. I think realistically, I take inspiration from life on Earth, because on Earth, there's already, I'm not a biologist, but I sometimes read about biology, and I am amazed about the species that are still being discovered, like at the ocean sea floor. It's just out of this world, quite literally, to imagine what kind of contraptions manage to have life. I think as for creativeness, I do resort to science fiction. And one recent movie that I saw that I really liked is Arrival. And it's about aliens, which are, well, their physical form is quite blobby, I guess, but they're really good at languages. And the whole film is also about language and how communication is the basis of any civilization. And I like that movie very much. And I hope that if we ever find aliens, they will be of the kind in Arrival.
That can communicate. One of the things I loved about your book was you talked about some of the earliest ideas, like the 16th century heretic named Giordano Bruno. And
yeah.
I'd love to hear about some of these early right. people. I mean, which ones in particular fascinated you?
Well, I mean, there's a lot even before Giordano Bruno, even in the classical Roman and Greek age. There were thinkers that conceived of civilizations among the stars. I chose Bruno because he wasn't an astronomer. He was a philosopher, or at least he called himself this. He was a heretic. He was viewed as such by the church, by the Catholic Church. And I think his writings were very profound. Like, he wrote things about, well, God is not unique, and actually humans are not unique because there's life among the stars. And he even, it wasn't a time where Copernicus, the Polish scientist who conceived of the sun being in the middle of the universe rather than the planets. Well, now we know that neither the sun nor the planets are at the center, nothing is at the center of the universe. But back then, this idea of the heliocentrism was quite revolutionary already. And what Giordano Bruno did was to export the heliocentric model, the Copernicus model, to the stars. He said, okay, Earth is a planet, goes around the sun is a star, so why don't other stars also have planets? I mean, it's quite straightforward. And in just two sentences in his writings, he just wrote down those thoughts and thereby presented the hypothesis that wasn't answered until four centuries later. Like, this is 25 years ago, that astronomers actually did find the first planet around another star. And my book was about, well, what happened in between? What happened to Bruno was quite tragic because he got burned at the stake. People say, well, he was a martyr for science. Well, again, he was not a scientist. He mainly liked to kick things up at the church, and he was burned for a lot of things. One of them was to think about other worlds, and another was serious blasphemy. So I'm not saying that's a right reason to burn someone, but it's just that, yeah, the story that's being made out of this is not so heroic as it's sometimes portrayed.
Yeah, but it does remind me of, you know, how the dreamers and the visionaries in their day are usually punished, yes, not rewarded.
Yes, and you see that time and again. I mean, look at only last century, Little Green Men is something that was being laughed at. I mean, this was the age, the Apollo age, well, the pre-Apollo age, actually at the beginning of the century, people were discovering the universe as a physics laboratory. Right, they discovered galaxies. They saw that the universe was expanding. They noticed that physics was happening in the universe that was also happening on Earth. And to study physics, one had to study the universe. And yeah, these were all these big questions, like how did everything came to be?
Yeah.
How did the laws of nature behave? And by that time, people were not interested in some planet around some uninteresting star. Yeah, I'm sure there'll be aliens somewhere. But it also got ridiculed a little bit because science fiction got popular again with the Apollo age. So we were going to the moon and what we find there. And yeah, it's easy to ridicule people who think about like aliens are on other planets. Maybe aliens already visited here on Earth. So, I mean, I don't think they have. Just for the record, but this whole alien thing got bucketed into this, yeah, non-scientific room. And it's only like what I said, like 30 years ago, that it started to be taken seriously.
Yeah, you know, I also think for me, when I see now recent pictures of even commercial astronauts now are going to space and taking these photos, right? The one thing that everybody seems to share is that the minute you get outside of your solar system, you realize your own insignificance, which is actually very important, I think, for not just for our own humility, but for our understanding of, you know, perspective and our yeah, place in a larger scheme.
Yeah.
So for that, but you, I'm curious about something that happened in 2014. I don't know if I'm saying this correctly. And Oumuamua?
Well, I'm not Hawaiian either. So Oumuamua, maybe.
Okay, but what happened in 2014?
Well, I think you refer to this interstellar comet, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Was it 2014?
I believe so. Or was it 2000 in and around that period?
In and around that year, yes. But I know what you're referring to, yes. So what happens, look, in astronomy, whenever we get new glasses, we see more things, right? So whenever, and that's what I like about astronomy. So whenever a new telescope has been built, new discoveries are being made. And what happened this time around is that, one of the many more new telescopes that have been built are facilities that are able to scan a lot of the sky and take photos often. So basically to make a movie to record a live version of the starry sky. And what you see there are what people call a transient events. So stars that appear and then disappear, and things like comets and dark bodies that are very faint, but are in the solar system. So one of those objects in 2014, was appearing very fast. So it was like a comet, but its velocity was such that implied that it had to come from outside the solar system, because within the solar system, the only thing that can propel you is the sun. A lot of the planets can, anything with gravity can, but the thing that has the strongest gravity force is the sun. So things can attain the highest velocity from the sun. And if it does, you just fly out the side of the solar system instantly. So whenever something appears with that velocity, it has to come from somewhere else, another solar system. And a lot of creative minds, among them Avi Loeb at Harvard University, who is a very distinguished astronomer, but also someone who really likes an outside hypothesis. So he said, well, what if it's aliens in a spaceship? And then like a lot of people ran with that hypothesis.
It had that shape, right? It had this weird, almost lava shape.
Yeah, yeah. It was very flattened and quite elongated. It didn't really look like a typical comet, which are more spherical. So yeah, sure. It looked really weird, and it was certainly remarkable. But in the years after that, more of the same kind were found. And
really?
And it is possible that in any solar system, rocks get flung out, and once they do, they get bombarded with cosmic radiation. So they get like rusty. Not literally rusty, but a bit like it. So they look a bit different from things that are in our own solar system. And yeah, so we got new glasses, and the first thing we saw was this weird thing. And now by now we have seen more of these weird objects.
As a storyteller, it reminds me of like characters that accidentally get off their own book and walk onto the pages of another book for a minute.
Yes, it was like a cameo, and also really like a brief one, because this interstellar comet went as fast as it came, because it couldn't break, right? It just comes through the solar system, gets deflected by the sun, and then it goes again. So thing is, it's not really available for follow-up observations. Yeah. So even if it was a spaceship, we would never find out.
So we don't really learn anything about our own solar system from these foreign visitors?
Well, I mean, the more that we record, the more we know. And indeed, we don't learn a lot about our own solar system, other than that gravity of our celestial bodies affects these things when they enter. Still, it does say something about how much debris is there in outer space, and what does that say about the long-term evolution of stars and planets? Those are questions that astronomers are happy to study, also by these objects.
And are we building any more toys, or we can see even more things? Like, what's the latest?
Oh yes, one of the latest that has been launched is called Euclid. It's a European space telescope. One of the few fully European space telescopes, which is focused on taking like a really a full frame photo of the universe, and quite a lot, as and also quite a deep photograph, so to speak. So I'm calling this, its mission is to take a big group photo of the universe in a similar fashion to what Hubble Space Telescope and James Webb Space Telescope have done before, called the extreme deep field. Meaning that you just point the telescope at a very uninteresting dark spot in the sky, and you just keep on integrating and keep on putting your lens open and collecting light. And then all of a sudden, like tens of thousands of galaxies appear. So those are not stars, but they're galaxies that each consist of hundreds of billions of stars. And that's really to study. And if you take this full frame version of it, so Hubble and James Webb just have like little moon-sized patches of the sky, but if you take like really almost half of the sky at once, you learn a lot about the cosmic structure, because the further you look, because all these galaxies are very far away, the more in the past you look, because light takes time to reach us. So you actually extend to the beginning of the universe, your slice of space-time, basically.
Why does that freak me out so much?
Because it's so big. And in astronomy, these order of magnitudes are, I mean, it freaks me out too. It's not that I understand it better than you do, how these large numbers work, and yeah, you don't feel those numbers. The only thing that you can do is like build a scale model and compare it to a tabletop model. And like, okay, so if we were a grain of sand, and then the sun would be like a golf ball or something like that.
You know, you work a lot with educating young people. You do a lot with television and so forth. Why is it important for young people? I'm really curious why we should start them young. I mean, do you have a feeling that it transforms them in some way or?
Yeah, I think it does. It gives children, it gives people the opportunity to be inspired and to wonder about the world around them and also the universe around them. I think it's important to know what you're part of, that you're part of your family and your city and the world and also the solar system and the universe. It's good to know the place where you are at. But for youngsters, I mean, it's such a good opportunity because children are fascinated by this stuff. Even from a very early age, they are very intrigued if they see the moon. And that's there that really incites questions. And the moon keeps changing its shape as well. That it just incites questions because you see a phenomenon and you want to explain it. And not everybody has to become an astronomer. God, I hope they don't, but there's other stuff that needs doing in the world. But it's a real good gateway to science, I think.
And I also think that, you know, if you become curious about the moon, then you'll be curious about your next door neighbor as well. That yes. It just, you know, like you can actually have heaven on earth too. You can, you know what I mean? This is what I feel.
Yes. And yeah, I mean, it goes back to what Carl Sagan, one of the big, I think it's a real big inspiration for anybody who knows of him. I mean, I'm too young to have experienced him firsthand, but he said he was this great astronomer and communicator. And he said about this photo that has been taken by the Voyager mission when it exited the solar system and looked back on Earth, and it was just one pixel basically on the camera that was Earth. And he had this whole very profound text about this is us, and everything that you know and happens took place on this really tiny speck in the universe. And it's both humbling, and also I think it's also it's humbling and you feel insignificant, but you also feel a bit proud because humans did make this spaceship that went into space, and we are capable of a lot of things beyond Earth. And that's also the possibilities are endless.
Speaking of spaceships, aren't you working on a second book called The Mission?
Yes. Yeah.
Tell me about that. I want to hear.
So where Planet Hunters, my first book, was about the story about are we alone in the universe and how did that question evolve through the centuries? This book is about what steps did we actually take to explore the universe. And it's a history of spaceflight, basically.
Mm.
So the first century of spaceflight. So about a century ago, the first rockets were built. And I find this a very interesting historical feat. And it's also, of course, cross-linked with politics and with history and with like a lot of events that happened in the past century, technology development. So what I did is I sought out a couple of individuals who have contributed in some way to spaceflight, either famous or not famous or infamous, describe them. And where I could, I interviewed them, and some of them have passed away, but a couple of individuals tell their stories, and along their stories I tell the history of spaceflight. And look, there's a lot of books on spaceflight and also on the history of spaceflight, but this is through my lens of, well, astronomer, space scientist, communicator, how I look at spaceflight as something that has its very inspiring and good sides, and also something that highlights some terrible things about humanity, I think.
I mean, so, how do you feel about commercial space flight for rich people right now?
I feel a bit ambivalent about that. In a way, it's the only way forward to, it's a costly enterprise space flight. And I'm all pro science. I think that we should not, I don't think we need space to survive as a species per se. We do need it to take care of our species on our planet, but I don't think that we need to go to other places in the universe. I mean,
what,
yes,
mean, okay. Sorry to interrupt you. What do you mean to take care of? You mean through satellite technology?
Yes, exactly. To satellite imagery, communication that has become very important thing about humanity. I think some things like tourism and internet are just expanding way too much, and I think they're quite disruptive. So I have some issues with those.
Wait, articulate. What do you mean they're disruptive?
Well, they're open-ended, and they're self-propelling. Like space tourism, it's expensive. It will get cheaper, and once it gets cheaper, it will explode like tourism did on Earth. And to be honest, I've been to a lot of interesting places just on the background of your Zoom. I've visited a lot of those places on the world, and I'm happy that I did. But so I've been part of tourism. But wherever I've encountered mass tourism, I found that a very disruptive thing on Earth. I mean, it invades nature, it invades communities, it invades cultures, and it usually, just takes care of a little part of it. And for the rest, it has a lot of bad and polluting sides.
I love your message, because I think what you're basically saying is we don't need to literally travel somewhere to travel somewhere.
No, exactly. Yes. And if an asteroid ever hits Earth again, like it did 65 million years ago when it killed the dinosaurs, sure, humanity will be having a problem. Still, I hope there will be other ways than colonizing the solar system to prevent humanity's fate to really go the wrong way. Yeah. So that's my ambivalence towards billionaires. Also, I think for this inspiration to kids, right? I think you grew up in a time when Apollo either was happening or just had happened,
well,
right?
Well, I was born in 61, and it was around the time that Kennedy was, you know, the biggest champion and advocate for space travel. So that was my era. And I remember in 1969 gathering at my Aunt Roshika's house to watch the walk on the moon.
Yeah, but you and a lot of people on the planet remember that time, and also remember that as an anchor point in their interests being kindled for science. Something about those astronauts that you saw. I mean, okay, they were all white men and American. so much for a role model to a lot of the world, but still, they were publicly recruited, and they were, in principle, they were just civilians to start with, and and they were brave. I mean, anything that you want to say, but they were brave. So they were an inspiration, and I still think that astronauts are an inspiration. And people in the Netherlands grow up with André Kuipers, and he's the most recent astronaut, and he's a big hero, and rightly so here. I think spaceflight is very visible, and it's also a signal for what can a society do, put people in space. Now, for the billionaires, what kind of message do they convey? Nowadays, if you want to go to space, the message that they convey is you just have to have a lot of money and then you can be an astronaut. And that has never happened before. And I think I feel very strongly about it being a wrong example to generations growing up. Like, kids should see themselves as an astronaut. They should see somebody who looks like them, somebody who is like them, somebody that they could one day be. And now it seems like all they have to do is just earn a lot of cash and escape any situation that they're in.
Luckily you're Dutch, so you're not quite as used to it. But, you know, this is something that Americans have done in every incarnation since I was a child. And it is rather distasteful that money trumps all. But I guess the exciting thing now is that there's this huge movement now to get kids into science and get women and young girls. And I believe the Netherlands even has a Dutch coin that's just come out with a female astronaut in it. So
I'm not even aware, but that's good. That's good to hear. Yeah. No, and I mean, a lot of initiatives exist and also quite visible initiatives that I really applaud. For example, the latest ESA recruitment of astronauts has been very much putting an effort into getting people from all genders and all, even people with a disability to apply, and with success. I mean, it's almost 50-50, the selection of the astronaut, the new astronaut corps of Europe, 50-50 male, female. And I think that's a good achievement. And the only thing that's why it worked was that all the females applied. There are no positive affirmative action policies at ESA. They just selected out of the pool the best candidates, and they ended up being 50-50. And I'm really happy about this because everybody deserves a role model.
I should mention ESA is the European Space Agency.
Yes, just sure. Yes, yeah. It is. Yeah.
That's pretty interesting that they didn't do any. I'm surprised they didn't do any affirmative action.
Yeah, and just to make sure, in America also these initiatives exist, and also there's an astronaut, a man of color, and a woman who will be the next moon astronauts for NASA. So yes, inclusion is actually on a government level being taken care of.
Yeah. Well, Lucas, I can't believe how fast the time went by. When does your book come out? Your second book?
Early 2024. So
that's like right around the corner.
Yes. Yeah. It's quite exciting. I just have to finish the last chapter, actually. Like, and the question that I will answer is, what is my mission? So I'm still grinding that one. And then
I want to be invited to the book party, and if there is none, I'll throw you one.
You will be invited for sure.
Thank you so much. I really I'm so excited to speak to somebody who has, in my opinion, all the right values, all the right dreams, and the right messaging. It's just so refreshing in such a difficult time that, you know, there's still this beautiful thing we can cling to. So thank you for that. And
thank you so much, Lisa. It was very nice talking to you.
I wish you all the best with your endeavors, and we'll speak soon.
You too. And yes, we will speak soon.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.